Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Let's get straight to the docket, because we've got a big one today. First, updates on the Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell matters, and wait till you hear what we have regarding Lori Vallow and the case against her in Arizona. Next, Brian Laundry, Gabby Petito update, an update on the college admission scandal trial. That's right, did you even know a trial was going on? An update on Alexis Starkey. Alex Murdoch. Wow, this guy is more manipulative than anybody thought. Scott Peterson, Derek Chauvin, and finally, our dumb criminal contestant of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk, the most fact-driven, unbiased, true crime channel, the channel where a practicing criminal defense attorney explains the facts, the procedure, and the law to cold cases and current actual criminal cases. Welcome. Now, if you haven't done so already, please hit that subscribe button, hit the thumbs up, hit that bell so they receive notifications of when we go live. And always, leave me a comment below about what you think about the cases that we talk about today. Now, remember, don't forget to listen to this show and past shows by downloading Crime Talk on all of your favorite podcasting apps like Apple, Spotify, iHeart, Android, Amazon, Audible, you name it, we're there. Now, before we get to the docket, let's take a quick moment to talk about some of our sponsors. Listen, we have some sponsors here that help us out. You can go to CrimeTalkPrep.com. They have a special for you if you need to get an emergency food supply. 3 months, right? 3 months, $100 off. But remember, you don't have to go buy 3 months worth of food. You can get less. You just buy what you need, what works for you. You can also go to CrimeTalkSearch.com, get yourself a background subscription service where you can run background checks on anyone here in the United States, and you can find out information about what they do for a living, they have a criminal history, are they a registered sex offender, are they married, are they divorced, what kind of property do they own, you name it, you're going to be able to find out about it. Just think, it doesn't have to be people you're dating, maybe people you know, maybe it's the parents of the kids that your kids are hanging out with, maybe somebody you just don't get a warm, fuzzy feeling about. Check them out, you'll be happy you did. Go to Crime Talk Prep, go to CrimeTalkSearch.com. We've got a big docket, so let's get to it. First on the docket, Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell. First, there was a motions hearing just the other day, and now the motions have kind of caught up with the filing system that they have there in Idaho. I've reviewed them, so you don't go and have to do it yourself. I took a look at them. It's basically a rehash of everything that was argued at the motion for change of venue. Basically, the government kind of wants to have their cake and eat it too. We've said this before, which is, yeah, let's do a partial motion for change of venue and maybe just move it, you know, one county over so it's really convenient for us. It won't cost a lot of money. And of course, John Pryor's motion on behalf of Chad Daybell is like, no, we're kind of all in. We're either going to move the case or we're not, but we can't get a fair trial. We'll see what the judge rules on this particular matter. This judge lives in the community. He's going to have a very good feel as to whether he thinks somebody's going to be able to get a fair trial. Normally, okay, and I'm telling you, I filed several motions for change of venue, but I work in a larger jurisdiction. The only time I've ever had any success was when it was a small community because everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows everything, okay? It's a real deal. So can you possibly find 12 jurors plus alternates who are going to be fair and impartial? Probably, but it's just going to have that kind of a taint that maybe, you know, since it is a death penalty case, maybe we should go a little above and beyond before we give somebody death to make sure at least we give them a fair trial by moving it out of the county where everybody lives and where it all took place, and it's small and everybody knows everybody, and it's just going to be a mess. I hope Judge Boyce moves it, and I hope he goes all in and moves it. And for my own selfish reasons, we hope maybe it's somewhere really nice, but everywhere in Idaho is nice, and we would like to go and check it out when we decide, when the judge decides where we're going to go, because Crime Talk is going to be there. Now, next we have Lori Vallow, okay? We put up some of the interviews that were released yesterday with Tylee, Lori Vallow, in regards to the death of her ex-husband, right? And you've got Alex Cox on there acting like no big deal. You've got Lori Vallow acting like it's no big deal. In fact, it is no big deal. What does she do after her ex-husband gets murdered by her brother? That's right. She goes to Burger King because she wants to have it her way. She takes Chuck Vallow's phone and the rental car and goes to Burger King. We've got the video. Hopefully we can play it right here for you. But guess what? There's more, okay? We are going to put up on our page all of the interviews, all of the telephone interviews, video and audio recordings. We're going to put those up so that you all can listen, all right? And you decide. Early on, even it looks like family members are saying she has just lost her mind. These dark spirits, all this stuff goes directly to the whole issue of competency. It's like, wow, maybe if somebody had done something, things had been done a little differently, maybe JJ and Tylee would still be here. But hindsight is 2020. We're gonna give the benefit of the doubt. Anyway, we're gonna put all those up over the next couple of days. It's a lot of stuff. Now let's move on to the Brian Laundry and Gabby Petito update. All right, first, Chris Laundry, the father of missing Brian Laundry, arrived Thursday at the park, which is adjacent to the Carlton Reserve, to help in the search for his son, Brian. Chris Laundry's pickup truck was parked near the locked gate at the Environmental Park after reporters outside the Laundry's Northport home said that Brian's father left the resident alone, reportedly carrying a plastic bag. Park rangers were there waiting for Christopher and the cops as they opened the gate to let him in. It has come to light that apparently Brian Laundry actually parked his car around 17 miles away from where his parents allegedly reported that they found it. That was his Ford Mustang. It was ticketed on September 14th at the Environmental Park, not the Carlton Reserve. Now, as a reminder, Laundry's parents initially said he left their home on September 14th for the Carlton Reserve, but the family's lawyer, Steve Bertolino, said the family was mistaken about that date when Brian Laundry left. Brian's parents now claim he left on September 13th. On Wednesday, authorities intensified search efforts at the Carlton Reserve for Brian Laundry. The police have not said what prompted the heightened search, which comes after several days of the search being scaled back. And the Laundry's family attorney reportedly said on Wednesday that Northport police had asked Chris Laundry to join the search for his son. They must be watching Crime Talk. The Laundry's family attorney also said that since the preserve had been closed to the public, Chris had not been able to look for Brian in the only place Brian's parents believe he may be. Now, in a most recent news, a source close to the Laundry family has stated that investigators found what appears to be a recently used campsite, as well as evidence of human activity in the Carlton Natural Reserve in Sarasota, Florida. Authorities have not confirmed the discovery of the campsite remnants, though photos and videos taken by local media outlets from the Carlton Reserve Wednesday showed increased police activity. Now, police told Chris Laundry that his participation would have to be postponed due to the discovery of the campsite, a claim that has not been confirmed by investigators. The plot thickens. I always thought it was odd that the family was not out looking for Brian Laundry, but now they have an excuse to. Gabby Petito's family revealed information that Gabby's body was found in the Spread Creek dispersed camping area of the Bridger-Teton National Forest, just a few feet away from the border with Grand Teton National Park. Now, as you may recall, Petito's body was found at what appeared to have been a campsite about 5 minutes away from where she and Brian Laundry would have parked their van. The dispersed campground are basically just open land where anybody can go and camp, where their van was alongside what was referred to as a creek bed. Petito's stepfather explained the site to reporters. In the picture, you can see where rocks have been moved to make a fire ring, and there's a clearing where he would assume that if they had a tent, that this is where they would put the tent. It would make sense to make it face overlooking the mountain range. Her body was found, he stated, would be in front of the tent if that was where the fire ring was. It wasn't far from where the van would have been parked as well, and Gabby's mother, Nicole Schmidt, said it would have been a 5-minute walk. She stated, you would have to want to go over to that area. People go down to go by the creek, but not a lot of people cross over there. It's not a place that's heavily trafficked. Now, the Gabby Petito case could get a little more complicated. Why, you might add? Well, there may appear to be in the surface figuring out exactly why or how she was killed. Investigators are not trying to figure out if Gabby was in fact slain where her body was found a couple weeks ago, which was in the vicinity of the Grand Teton National Park and the Bridger-Teton National Forest Service in Wyoming. Now, the National Park and National Forest is all federal land, which is why the FBI has taken the lead on this case. However, if it is determined that Gabby was not killed on federal land, then the case would have to be turned over to the state authorities in charge. So the big question is, if it's uncertain, who has jurisdiction to prosecute the alleged killer? If there's no way to determine where Gabby was killed, the default will be where she was found. And since it's on federal land, the U.S. attorney would prosecute the case. Now, if, however, there's ambiguity and state authorities believe her body was moved there, the state and the feds could be at odds. Now, remember, for there to be federal jurisdiction, you have to have interstate commerce. That's why most crimes, wire fraud, drugs, the feds take it when it moves over state lines, interstate commerce, or it has to be on exclusive federal land, right? Makes sense. If it's not, it's on state land. That decides where the case be prosecuted. Now, you can always prosecute, as stated, as a fallback where the body was found if nobody knows exactly where it took place. It's going to be an interesting question, but first, they need to indict and or charge Brian Laundrie, if he is the one that they can actually prove it. And then, of course, they need Brian Laundrie to show up in court. They cannot try him in absentia. All right. Remember the college admission scandal? Not a whole lot of news about it lately because, you know, all the famous movie stars are pretty much out of it. Well, a federal jury is set to begin, actually started its deliberations this morning in the Varsity Blues college admission case following a nearly 4-week criminal trial for two parents accused of committing fraud and bribery to get their children admitted to the University of Southern California as athletes. Now, prosecutors and defense attorney made closing arguments yesterday in the U.S. District Court in Boston. Prosecutors attempted to persuade jurors that defendants John Wilson and Gamal Abdel Aziz, unwilling to settle for an uncertain path for their teens, conspired with the corrupt California college counselor, William Rick Singer, who offered a guarantee. In exchange for payment, he would get the teens tagged as recruited athletes, even if they weren't star players. Several coaches have pled guilty to taking bribes from Mr. Singer. Two others and a USC administrator are slated for trial in the coming months. This will be a watershed moment for everybody to get an idea as to the likelihood of future convictions. Now, Assistant United States Attorney Stephen Frank told jurors in closing that the defendants knew the money they gave Mr. Singer was to be used as a bribe. Whether or not they understood every detail of the plan didn't matter. Frank replayed recorded conversations introduced during the trial between Singer and the number of his clients. Defense attorneys argued that Mr. Singer conned their clients, created the athletic profile behind their backs, and that the businessmen believed they were making lawful donations via Singer's foundation. Prosecutors called 14 witnesses in their case against Mr. Abdel Aziz, a former casino executive, and Mr. Wilson, a private equity financier and former Staples and Gap Inc. executive. Now, Brian Kelly, Mr. Abdel Aziz's attorney, said his client never agreed with Mr. Singer to bribe anyone and never agreed to commit fraud. Mr. Wilson acted in good faith and thought he was dealing with a trusted college advisor. Prosecutor said Mr. Abdel Aziz paid $300,000 and conspired with Mr. Singer in 2017 to get Mr. Abdel Aziz's daughter, Sabrina, into USC as a basketball recruit, though she didn't even make her high school varsity team. Now, the government's accused Mr. Wilson of paying a total of more than $1.5 million to work with Mr. Singer to get his son, Johnny, flagged as a USC water polo recruit, and again years later to help his twin daughters land spots as sailors. Johnny Wilson got into USC and quit the water polo team after his first semester. The alleged scheme was uncovered before the twins finished high school. Now, during the trial, an FBI agent testified that falsified athletic profiles were found in email accounts that the defendants used. Both the defense lawyers insisted that their clients never saw the emails. In the government's rebuttal at the end of the closing arguments, Mr. Frank told the jury that it wasn't plausible. These two men are on the opposite sides of the world. They both missed the exact same email? Think about the odds. What are the chances? Among other calls prosecutors replayed Wednesday was one from October of 2018 in which Mr. Singer, by then a government cooperator, told Mr. Abdel Aziz that Mr. Singer's foundation was being audited. Mr. Singer used that cover story to get a number of parents talking on the recorded line. It states, quote, "I'm not going to tell the IRS anything about the fact that your $300,000 was paid to Donna Heinel at USC to get Sabrina into school, even though she wasn't a legitimate basketball player at that level." Mr. Singer said, "You're okay with that?" "Of course," Mr. Abdel Aziz responded. Now, Mr. Kelly, Mr. Abdel Aziz's attorney, said the calls were setup tapes meant to frame his client. Attorney for both men focused during the trial on Mr. Singer's mixing of words like donation and payments in his communication with the parents. Now, Mr. Kendall called witnesses who said Johnny Wilson practiced with the USC team, an effort to rebut testimony to the contrary by the USC assistant water polo coach. We talked about this when this case was going on early. Obviously, these parents had a lot of resources to get their kids into the college that they wanted, although it really is just cheating, okay? If you're going to make a donation to the school, you go directly to the school. It would seem as though common sense would prevail that why am I not making a donation to the school if I'm making a donation to the school? Why does it have to go through this third party unless something was fishy? And let's face it, these parents knew that their kids did not have the athletic ability to compete at the college level. And every parent has that dream. Every parent thinks their young little kid in peewee football or baseball or swimming or whatever is going to be the next Olympian, the next star in professional sports. And they will do anything to get them there. But it usually involves a lot of practice. And it usually involves them actually participating in that sport. I think there's going to be guilty verdicts on this. I wasn't there at the trial. We will have to wait and see, but it just seems a little shaky, and I'm not sure why they didn't cut deals. You never know. We'll see if the jury decides. Whatever the jury decides is the correct decision. All right, let's talk about Alexa Sharkey. Now, she's the former popular Instagram influencer who had about 1.5 million followers, and then she was found deceased on the side of a highway back in November of 2020 in Houston, Texas. Now, Alexis Sharkey's husband, Tom Sharkey, was found this week with an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound in the head. Sharkey's body was discovered by a regional fugitive task force at his daughter's Florida home on Tuesday night while serving an arrest warrant in connection to his wife's presumed murder. I think that pretty much wraps that case up because, well, if you knew they were coming in for an arrest warrant, why would you do that if you were innocent? You wouldn't. It shows consciousness of guilt. All right, now on the docket, Alex Murdoch. What can you say about this guy? But man, what more could this guy get away with? All right. Now, according to new legal documents, Alex Murdoch set up a fake firm called Forge to siphon off $3.5 million of the $4.3 million settlement money meant for his housekeeper, who was mysteriously killed at his home. A motion filed Tuesday by attorneys for Gloria Satterfield's family provides new details of how two large payouts from two separate insurers were allegedly redirected to what was essentially a P.O. box in Hampton, South Carolina, instead of making their way to Satterfield's sons, Tony Satterfield and Brian Harriet. Two of the defendants had been named in the civil suit, Murdoch's old college roommate, Corey Fleming, who acted as lawyer on behalf of Satterfield's family. Also accused is Chad Westendorf, vice president of Palmetto State Bank. Murdoch encouraged Satterfield's son to hire Westendorf to deal with business matters he said that could arise. The new motion filed on Tuesday is now calling for Murdoch and his alleged co-conspirators to be held in contempt for violating the orders approving the settlement. Murdoch, Fleming, and Westendorf are accused of negotiating $4.3 million in payouts from Lloyd's Underwriters and Nautilus Insurance Company, two insurance companies in which Murdoch held policies. They then allegedly sent more than 3.5 of the funds to Murdoch's shell company called Forge. Satterfield's sons were allegedly kept in the dark about both the settlement and the court meetings and were not invited to any mediations and didn't receive a dime of the settlement. Westendorf was appointed as the new personal representative of Satterfield's estate on December of 2018, replacing her son Tony. The very next day, Fleming filed a petition to get court permission to access a partial settlement in the wrongful death suit for $505,000 while reserving the right to pursue additional insurance coverage that is applicable to this matter. Satterfield's sons believe this settlement was agreed prior to the change in hands between Tony and Westendorf. A check for the settlement was dated December 4th of 2018, 2 weeks prior to Westendorf's appointment. This partial settlement was approved by Judge Carmen Mullen, but the sons claim they were never told anything about it. On January 7th of 2019, Fleming then allegedly received a $505,000 check from Lloyd's Underwriters. That same day, Fleming allegedly wrote a check for $403,500 to Murdoch's shell account for the company called Forge. According to the suit, a company in Atlanta, Georgia shares this name, but in fact, this check was sent to a P.O. box in Hampton at Murdoch's request. In March of 2019, Fleming then secured additional settlements from Nautilus Insurance Company to the tune of $3.8 million, which Satterfield's son again claimed they had no knowledge of taking place. Westerfield signed a conditional release, which stipulated the funds would be paid directly to him in April of 2019. Now, these documents included in the motion reveal the check was made payable to Westendorf as the estate representative and Fleming's law firm on April 18th. In total, two insurance companies had paid out $4.3 million. Minus legal fees and expenses, Satterfield's family were entitled to $2.765 million in a settlement, which was approved by the judge on May 13th. A check submitted with the motions reveal Fleming sent a check for $2.96 million to Forge the very same day. Then on October 5th of 2020, Murdoch filed for a dismissal because a settlement, which Mullins approved, had been reached between the parties. The next day, on October 6th, Fleming wrote a check to Forge for $168,000. Fleming also paid himself $666,000 in legal fees. He was awarded $1.435 million in fees, $168,333 in the Lloyd's payout and $1.27 million in the Nautilus deal, but allegedly paid the remainder to Murdoch. Now, Westendorf did not appear to pay himself for his involvement. He allowed all of the settlement proceeds to be misapplied by Fleming and Murdoch. The settlement statement signed by Westendorf also lists prosecution expenses of $105,000 deducted from the $4.3 million total package, but this is not clear where the money went. Wow, you gotta wonder how many times this has taken place. This guy is manipulative, ladies and gentlemen. Now, obviously, we'll give him the presumption of innocence because he has not been charged, but this is not looking good. We know he tried to have somebody kill himself or make it look like he was going to kill himself. Man, this guy is manipulative. Now, the law firm, which formerly employed Alex Murdoch, also announced yesterday that they will be suing the attorney to recoup money the firm says Murdoch slipped into a suspicious account without permission. Now, the law firm known by PMPED, short for Peters, Murdoch, Parker, Elsroth, and Dietrich, says its former partner converted client and the firm's money to his own personal use. In the lawsuit, it alleges, in early of September of 2021, the firm discovered that Alex Murdoch had a bank account with Bank of America in the name of Alex Murdoch, doing business as Forge, a fictitious entity that provides no services and makes no products for sale. It was further learned that Alex Murdoch used this account to convert monies owed to the firm and its clients to his own personal use. The firm discovered a suspicious check for professional services made out to Alex Murdoch Esquire, but not to the firm. That check raised suspicions at the firm that something was amiss, the lawsuit alleges. Now, the firm says it confronted Murdoch about the matter on September 3rd. That's the day before Murdoch was shot in the head, allegedly by a man Murdoch asked to kill him so he could avoid committing suicide and still pass his surviving son Buster $10 million through a life insurance policy. Now, Alex Murdoch survived the shooting and is currently facing criminal charges connected to that particular incident. He claims he's addicted to opioids and that he has no money left to his name. I'm sure he has no money left to his name. I don't know if it was just from drugs. Maybe it was gambling. Maybe it was women. Who knows? But clearly, Alex Murdoch was living a second life, trying to con just about everyone. And we can't make certain allegations, but I would bet that the authorities are looking at any possibility that Mr. Murdoch may have done it himself or had somebody harm his wife, Maggie, and their son, Paul. We'll wait and see. I think something's coming. I think they're coming close. And as soon as Mr. Murdoch gets out of rehab, and I'm hoping they're watching that rehab place real close, because clearly Alex Murdoch has an idea of where he should go when he's got to go. Scott Peterson, remember that guy? Yeah, it's been a while, but he was on death row for the death of his wife and unborn child. Well, on Wednesday, a California judge set a date to resentence Scott Peterson to life in prison. While word of whether a new trial will happen remains unanswered. The district attorney is still deciding whether Peterson should receive a new trial for the 2002 murders of his pregnant wife, Lacey, and their unborn child, Connor. Until then, he'll continue to serve a life sentence behind bars. Now, last year, the California Supreme Court overturned Peterson's death sentence after jurors who reportedly disagreed with the death penalty but were willing to impose it were dismissed from the case. The court stated that there was enough circumstantial evidence to incriminate Peterson for murdering his wife and unborn son. The DA said that she expects that the resentencing to last a few hours. The resentencing date has been scheduled now for December 8th. Now, there still has to be a hearing on whether the juror who didn't disclose some significant facts, which I think is pretty bad. I think jurors need to disclose. They need to be honest and don't write books and don't have a similar DV type situation in your past. That may get Scott Peterson a new trial, if you can believe it or not. We'll see. Whatever, if the judge doesn't grant a new trial, it will go back up through the appellate courts and we'll have to see if it comes back down or just give him a new trial. Jury misconduct has to be taken seriously. It goes to the heart of the criminal justice system. And if you have people that are there, not to be fair and impartial, but to have an agenda, well, the system breaks at that point. And if you find evidence of it, I think the defendant should get a do-over. Now let's talk about Derek Chauvin. Remember this guy? You know, now he's in custody for 25 years. Well, there was a ruling signed by a Minnesota Supreme Court justice that upheld the office of the Minnesota Appellate Public Defender and their denial of Chauvin's request for representation. Chauvin had claimed that he didn't have the funds to cover the costs of a private attorney, In other words, he's broke and he wants to have a court-appointed attorney represent him to appeal his murder convictions. And basically they said he has to hire his own attorney, but he can't, so that he should be entitled to a public defender. Well, the court denied Chauvin's request without prejudice, which means he can bring another request. If it was with prejudice, that means you can't bring the request again. So that left the door open for a possible public defender appointment in the future. And if the former police officer becomes eligible under Minnesota law, it apparently is up to Chauvin to show that he was unable to pay the reasonable costs charged by a private attorney to defend him. Chauvin states that due to his incarceration, he doesn't have the means to retain a private counsel for the appeal, and he has no source of income, nor does he own any real property or vehicles. His only asset is apparently a couple of retirement accounts, and he said he would face significant penalty for accessing these retirement funds. At trial, though, Chauvin was represented by attorney Eric Nelson, who's still listed as Chauvin's attorney in the federal case currently pending against Derek Chauvin. Nelson has confirmed he does not represent Chauvin for his appeal at this time. Now, Wednesday's ruling comes almost 2 weeks after Chauvin's late September request to proceed in formis pauperis. That's a fancy legal term that basically says you're poor, would give him a reprieve from having to pay the usual court fees and costs that come with pursuing a legal action. Judge Peter Cahill, who oversaw Chauvin's murder trial, initially granted that request, but just one day later reversed himself and ruled that Chauvin could afford to pay for his legal fees after all. I'll be honest with you, this decision somewhat is perplexing to me. When somebody is in custody, they're usually presumed to be indigent. And unless there's some information out there that somebody has a ton of money, they don't qualify. But normally you qualify when you're in custody. And ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you a little secret here. Lawyers are expensive. And to get an appellate attorney who's going to have to pay for the costs of all the transcripts, take the time to review, get familiar with the case, see if there's any issues, analyze, draft motions. We're literally talking hundreds of hours, which could mean hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, I don't know what Derek Chauvin has in his retirement account, but like most people, if you take your retirement account money early, you pay 50% tax on it. Well, I don't really have a whole lot of sympathy for that. But, you know, if you got to pay for your attorneys, you got to pay for your attorneys. I appreciate the fact you want to keep your retirement money there, maybe when you get out of prison or to make your time in custody more comfortable. But if you got the funds, you got to pay. I'm just a little surprised that the public defender's office wouldn't jump all over that case. And I understand Derek Chauvin is not a very well-liked man, but he's still entitled to due process, which means he's in custody, he's broke, he should get an attorney at no cost to him. It's just part of the criminal justice system. It's the cost of doing business to make sure that everyone receives a fair trial, as well as having their review at the appellate courts if there is a conviction. Okay, now we move on to a segment. It's called the Dumb Criminal Contestant of the Day. And occasionally I have somebody who says, Scott, why do you have to use the word dumb? That's mean. It's insensitive. A lot of these people probably have mental health issues. I get it, okay? I've been practicing criminal defense for 26 years. A large percentage of the people in the criminal justice system have mental health issues. No one is insensitive to that. In fact, I am frankly probably hypersensitive to that, since so many of my serious cases involve mental health issues. Now, let's face it. Even if you have mental health issues, or you could be a freaking genius for all I care, you can still do dumb things. Now, it's usually not the mental health issues that make people do dumb things. And as you've seen kind of over the years, it's kind of a pattern that has developed. It usually involves drugs and alcohol. Just saying, I think that's a fair statement. Now, could these people have been self-medicating? Perhaps that's the case, but they still do it. And I think this is the problem with the world today, is everyone takes everything with such a sense of hypersensitivity that we get lost sometimes and just have a little fun, okay? And if anybody knows and I think as a criminal defense attorney, all right, every now and then you have to be able to have a good laugh. We deal with a lot of bad things that take place, all right? I told you, like yesterday, I got to spend my day and my day again today looking at crime scene photos from a horrific homicide, okay? And every now and then, it's nice to be able to have a bit of a laugh. So let me just do this. I was thinking about having a poll. Should we do a dumb criminal contestant or not? Should we change the name to some politically correct version or not? But you know what? I've thought about it. This is still America, and nobody forces you to listen to the dumb criminal section of our program. We actually announce it every time that we're going to talk about our dumb criminal contestant of the day. So if it offends you, please just stop watching at that point, or I guess you can stop watching me altogether. Take it for what it is, ladies and gentlemen. It's good people. We're going to assume they're good people. They may have mental health issues, but they've done something dumb. Well, let's take, for example, our Los Angeles County Sheriff deputy we talked about several months ago. He allegedly was having sex while on duty at Universal Studios and mistakenly left his microphone on for a dispatcher to hear, yep, the entire encounter. Well, he's been fired. The deputy, who has not been publicly identified, was fired for violating departmental policies, rules, during the X-rated encounter in December with a woman near the Bates Motel section of the Universal Studios in Hollywood. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I guess we should add sex, right? We add alcohol, drugs, and the big things that always will keep society where we need laws, sex, drugs, and alcohol every time. That's what happened to this officer. Now, is he a bad officer? No. Is me commenting on that going to somehow make this officer not be able to get a job someday? No. I think his conduct would maybe give somebody pause to hire him in the future. Not our dumb criminal segment. And although it was just a rule, a policy for sure, that sheriff's officer, that's right, that sheriff's deputy, he's our dumb criminal contestant of the day. And tomorrow, we'll have a recap of all of them, and you can vote. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.